Hey, welcome out to the backwoods. It's been a minute. Was afraid maybe y'all had lost the path, but this is Jeff. I'm here, and so is Ben, my regular co-host. Like I just said, it's been a minute. Ben, how you been doing, bud?
Oh, not bad. Just busy.
Yeah.
We've both been pretty occupied with other things, so it's been hard to find some time to get together. But
right.
I'm told that our podcast now shows up in Apple Podcasts down at the bottom with all of the other defunct podcasts. So we're still here.
maybe the update will fix that. I do hate that we haven't had a chance to record, but like you said, real life commitments kind of get in the way sometimes. I do want to say thanks to everybody who reached out on social media to say that they'd love to hear a new episode. That's really kind of y'all. And feels nice to be missed. So thank y'all.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's kind of a grab bag. Do we want to start with Mark Driscoll embracing the cult of Ishtar theory?
Yeah. So I'm sure most of the people who listen to us have seen it, but if not, he was at some men's conference. I hesitate to even call it that. I don't know exactly what was going on there, but it was some kind of weird, like, strongman conference. It seemed like a blast from the past. I haven't seen conferences like that in a long time, but they used to be kind of a regular thing where you get a bunch of dudes together and like monster trucks and all kinds of crazy, like, pro-America stuff. They probably had a screening of Rocky IV.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of heartwarming to see that it was still there. Yeah. And then you're like, oh man, they paused it, you know?
Yeah. But I guess they had Mark Driscoll was there speaking, and I guess before he got up, they had like some, I don't even know how to describe it, some dude like doing acrobatics or something. I'm not sure what it was exactly. I mean, I just saw,
you know, usually when there's a pole and dancing, we call it pole dancing. I appreciate you trying to be kind here, but
no, honestly, I didn't even think of that term.
No, we have a concept here.
Yeah, you're right. I guess I'm just too homeschooled.
Church, we would call it what it is, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was worse than the ballet guys for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, they had some dude, I guess, pole dancing, and Driscoll got up and was like, "I guess he's publishing a new book about the spirit of Jezebel or something," and it's kind of like, if you've listened to our episode about the Jonathan Cahn book, The Return of the Gods, I think it's a lot of similar concepts to that, where he's talking about the idea that these old dark spiritual forces have kind of reemerged in America. And he uses the example of Jezebel, I think is what he uses, and describes kind of like the way that the Asherah poles were worshipped back in Israel and things like that. And, says that's happening here at this conference. And I guess the pastor who put the conference on kicked him off stage and told him to stop. And then he got back and apologized or something. Some series of events happened. But I thought it was interesting because it's nice to see other people getting on board with the, maybe he's listening to Backwoods Belief.
Yeah, if he's smart, he is. this is the perfect encapsulation of Mark Driscoll, right? Like it's a running train wreck, but every now and then you see the like old fastball come out. And you know, there are people speculating it's some kind of op, and I get being cynical that way and assuming it was some kind of promo and all that. But, you know, every now and then, particularly where it's connected to men's issues, the good Driscoll briefly emerges and you're like, oh yeah, I remember why that guy had such heft at one time, you know, but it gets drowned back out by the normal nonsense that has, you know, like I just said, drowned him. So it was kind of a trip to kind of go back through the whole Driscoll experience in a 24-hour cycle on social media.
Yeah. It made me think of what we said on the podcast we did about Return of the Gods, where we were like, how right is it that God would choose somebody kind of crazy and disrespected, and you know, in Driscoll's case, sort of has, I guess, disqualified himself. I don't know all of what went on at Mars Hill, and I don't really care to know. But this guy who had his reputation ruined, and it's somewhat it's it's like God to use a guy like that to give a nugget of truth to us.
Right. Right.
So that was
shame the wise. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Shame the wise.
What I really wish I had access to was a live feed of Mike Cosper watching that story go down. Because he's, you know, the meme with a guy sweating his way through choosing between two different buttons. He's literally torn between, oh my gosh, there's a male stripper involved, or there's criticize Mark Driscoll. You know, you've got two of his favorite things there, and he doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, so that's been happening. That's exciting news in the Christian world. We're not going to do the whole episode about that because there's not enough to say. And if you're really interested in the topic, go listen to the Return of the Gods episode, because it is a compelling, there's a compelling case to be made that he's not wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. It's in the archives as how pride becomes a new national identity.
That's right. And, yeah.
I'm going to throw that in the hopper, Ben, to talk about coming up. Hopefully we'll record more frequently, but I'm leading a conference call on how to pastor during Pride Month. And I'd like to take a backwoods approach also to Pride Month, and kind of help people get ready for that.
Yeah.
I think I should note, just to be clear, I don't know Mike Cosper likes male strippers, but I know he's effeminate. And so I'm making a joke that the man is having to choose between criticizing Mark Driscoll or doing something effeminate. And I just want to be crystal clear about what my criticism and joke at his expense is aimed at. I don't know for sure, but I know for sure he's effeminate. And I wanted to get a dig in at him.
All right. Well, we're starting this off this episode off strong.
Yeah, man. He's the worst. Far, you know, what I do know of the Mars Hill thing, I think Driscoll ran from accountability. But whatever, you know, anger issues he had that Cosper documented in his Fall of Mars Hill podcast, Cosper's feminism and sort of the set that he represents, their effeminate approach to the world, is far worse of a problem than Mark Driscoll's anger issue.
Yeah. And I mean, as with a lot of those criticisms, they may have a thing or two right about what they're criticizing Driscoll on, but the reason they're doing it has nothing to do with, you know, caring about the peace and purity of the church.
Right. Right. It's honoring the spirit of the age and, oh no, toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
Well, as I mentioned, this is a grab bag. The thing I wanted to talk most about, although you've suggested a third topic that I'm looking forward to as well, but the one that kind of was in my hopper is the controversy right before Easter around the phrase "Christ is King."
And I forgot that happened at Easter. Like, it was Palm Sunday.
Yeah. Yep.
Which has its own particular irony.
Yeah. So Palm Sunday, it's supposed to become wrong think to say Christ is King because some allegedly bad group of people, allegedly somewhere on the internet, were allegedly using it in ways that weren't happy.
Yeah.
It is so disappointing that Christians fall for that stuff.
Yeah, every time too.
Every time, man.
It's no surprise that we fail to win at these things when every time an accusation is made like that, oh, you only say that because, you know, you're anti-Semitic or something. I think that was the original claim. It's anti-Semitism. Yeah. That we fall for the pit of thinking that these people are actually like have legitimate criticisms and and we go back on it, and then it becomes now a controversial thing to even say the words "Christ is King." Like they got exactly what they wanted out of that.
Yes, and let me ask you this: you know, how do you define who they are? Because it seems crystal clear to me. I put this on social media for anybody who follows me. There is some third-rate swamp demon out there who said, "You know what we're going to try this year? Right before Easter, we're going to make it bad for people to say Christ is King." And it just kills me that they had a measure of success.
Yeah.
I don't know who the they is. You know, I think the Clavins were involved, which is its own kind of thing. Andrew Clavin started this, and
Shapiro definitely was involved.
Who was?
Ben Shapiro, because it was Candace Owens, and all of that.
Right. And like, Clavin has an openly sodomite son. You know, we're going to take counsel on Christian confession from a guy whose household is disordered. What are we talking about?
Yeah.
And here's the thing. I don't know, and I don't follow the Clavins. I don't know them from Adam. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, if Andrew is deeply mournful over that, that's great. That should be the appropriate position in that situation. But he's still not someone who, you know, has the qualifications to get up and instruct the church about how the church should conduct herself, particularly not on a fundamental confession of her faith that predates English. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me of, it's like Michael O'Fallon stopping people from evangelizing James Lindsay. It's almost like Clavin has the same relationship with Shapiro. Because I remember when this was all happening, Clavin was like, well, you know, Ben does all of this good stuff. And it turned into a defense of this guy who rejects Christ. On the basis of him rejecting Christ, like it was on the basis of like being Jewish is a large part of Ben Shapiro's identity. Right. And Clavin's argument for not saying Christ is king is that it would in some way violate this man's identity, whether, you know, ethnic or religious. And, you know, it's like, so what? Christ is king. Right. That's just the reality. And if that's offensive to you as a person, that's your problem.
Right. Well, it's an offensive statement to anyone who doesn't acknowledge Christ as king. I mean, that the gospel is an offense. We were aware of that before anybody got offended by it. We've been aware of that for thousands of years at this point.
Yeah. I think part of the reason that people are actually like, you know, they're calling it bad or anti-Semitic or whatever other criticism they have of it now is that they're beginning to realize that people mean it.
Yeah.
Like it's not just some platitude.
Right. But they mean it in a way that's going to affect their public life.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And that is exactly why the whole Christian nationalism thing has become a problem, is because people are recognizing, oh, you actually think that Christ rules over the nations and that should do something to the nations.
There's some kind of obligation there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so the point that I really wanted to stake down, and I hope our listeners will. I'm guessing our listeners probably know this, actually, but I just want to stake it down for all of us for the future. Christianity is self-referential and self-defining. Christianity is not defined by any reaction outside of Christianity to Christianity. Because it is the product of God's work, it is absolute. Now, of course, there are important differences within Christianity where we try to understand precisely what God intended, right? So again, Ben and I disagree about who the right subject of baptism is and what baptism actually is. Those are important disagreements. But within the Orthodox faith, Christianity is absolute. And so it doesn't matter what any group reacting positively or negatively has to the central claims of Christianity. Christianity defines what those terms mean. And so if the most elite people in society embrace the fundamental confessions of Christ, praise the Lord, that's a gift. If the worst people in society adopt them for evil ends, that does nothing to the claims themselves. Christianity is self-defining. Yeah. And we have to take that kind of posture in a world that wants to impose all kinds of different meanings upon Christianity, not the least of which is, dangerous threat to the social order. Christianity has been around for a while. We know what the fundamental confessions say. They predate any existing authority structure that's going to try to impose itself upon the faith, and we should just act like it. We know what we are. And we're happy to tell you you're wrong, and we're going to keep doing what we've been doing for thousands of years.
Yeah, and it actually is a danger to the social order, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And again, it's been a danger to the social order in all the best ways throughout history, if I can offer an apologetic. You know, the British Empire stopped trading in slaves because Christianity was a danger to their social order. And now that, you know, the regime wants to make it some kind of scary problem for their evil, we're still just going to keep doing it. You know, that I guess the thing that really got under my skin is that on Easter, if you pick me up, put me in an airplane and drop me in any part of the world where there's a Christian church, if my brothers and sisters there could figure out a way to communicate, when we both say to each other, Jesus Christ is Lord or Christ is King, there's an immediate fellowship because it's part of the global identity of the church. And I'm supposed to care that somebody at the Daily Wire says it's a problem. It's ridiculous. Yeah. And I can't stand this idea that has become so popular that Christianity is reactionary. It's not reactionary. Christianity is an expression of the God who controls all things. Everything else reacts to him, including the true faith that is in his son.
Yeah, and there's a point to be made, too, where when there's a specific claim that Christianity makes on the world, and that claim is the one that you're told you may not say, right, that's the right time to say it, even if you are being reactionary.
Right. Because
they've told you, at this point, you cannot say Christ is King for a variety of reasons. That's exactly where you need to park. Like, that's where you need to say, no, I will defend this point. He is King. And it doesn't matter who that offends.
Yes, exactly, Ben. I mean, we've talked about, you know, on here before that being reactionary is good, but you have to do it the right way. And you have to react in a way that assumes the superiority of what God has done in Christ to all other earthly powers. We talked off air. I'm convinced that the reason that this message got traction in the church is because of pragmatism as applied to ecclesiology and attractional church ministry. We've been told for so long that Christianity is a product to be sold to people, and that it, you know, as salesmen, we need to accommodate Christianity to their existing appetites and their existing tastes. And it is such a infernal subversion of the proclamation of the gospel and teaching the nations to obey all that Christ has commanded. So that when someone comes along and says something so stupid as, you shouldn't say Christ is Lord, because somebody out there is using it in a mean way, in a way that people don't like, we have been made so stupid by marketers that we think that's actually a point worth considering.
Yeah. It's I hear sometimes, and sometimes this is true, but not in a case like this, but you'll hear sometimes people say, oh, that's bad optics.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, okay, maybe it is, but that doesn't matter. And in fact, good optics in this case, if, you know, if they're right, good optics in this case is a betrayal of the Christian faith. It's a betrayal of God.
Right.
Like, it's, right, it reminds me of that sermon I've talked about before, 10 shekels and a shirt, where, you know, all of these guys were doing all of these things to get one up in the situation. And nobody was considering what God thought in any of it.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a singular
audience.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we had a text. That's the other thing too. You brought this up online, but it's one of those deals where, like, we do run in sometimes into tricky situations. We're like, how does the Christian faith address this? How do our theological principles apply? But this is one of those ones where we had a thou shalt, you know, basically. You want to read that for us?
Yeah. So this is in Philippians chapter 1. Paul's talking. He says, some indeed preach Christ, even from envy and strife, and some also from goodwill. The former preach Christ from selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing to add affliction to my chains. But the latter out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached, and in this I rejoice, yes, and will rejoice. So, yeah, we have a text to point to. We have a clear example of something happening. He even uses, I love that, I'm so thankful that he uses the word envy, because that's the one that, you know, in all of these discussions of Christian nationalism or saying bad things about Jewish people, or, you know, using Christ as King as an anti-Semitic slur, the common argument is that it's people who are envious. Well, Paul directly addresses that and says, yeah, some people do preach Christ from envy. And guess what? I rejoice because Christ is preached.
Right. Their motivations are irrelevant because Christianity is self-defining. The gospel is the gospel. And it doesn't matter what aims a person who wants to use it has. It is intrinsically powerful because of the God who imbued it with his own power through his spirit. We had a text and we went listening to the Clavins. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. You have the holy revelation of God and you're like, well, what do right-wing thought leaders think we should do? This is tough. It's so disappointing.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it too is tied up in another kind of reactionary thing that happens in the political sphere, which is, you know, it has somehow become like Trump coded or right wing coded to say Christ is king. And so all of the people who, like Jenna Ellis, for example, who's, you know, got a bee in her bonnet about Donald Trump now, she came out, you know, strongly against this I think probably she would say she believes Christ is king. She probably did say that at some point in this whole discussion. But because it was something where she could define herself as not those right-wing people, she came out against the statement Christ is king. And anytime you're doing something like that where you're letting – you're being reactionary like you're talking about. Anytime you're letting your enemies define what you can and cannot say because of – you know, you don't want to be aligned with them, you've run into a serious problem, especially when it comes to Christianity.
Well said.
There are a lot of people I don't like who say true things. That doesn't make it any less true.
Yeah. And as the children of the king, anything true that is said out there is our inheritance. You know, read your Augustine. The Egyptian's gold is ours. We don't define according to marketing terms what the course is for the church. I just cannot stress that enough. And stop doing it. You know, I saw James Lindsay warning. I think James tried to like thread the needle on this. He told Christians to practice their faith, but he said, you know, you're being set up for persecution by the political apparatus that we live under. He's right on that front. Guess what? Christ is king, and that's what they need to hear as they aim their weapons at the church. We're still going to just live in the truth, no matter what your, you know, whatever petty resources you think you can bring to bear against us.
Yeah. And you know what? Even if it is all an op, like they are setting us up for persecution. Yes. Like Jesus, we have a verse for that too. Jesus told us, you know, they hated me. They're going to hate you.
Right.
Like you're not better than me. So if they hated me, they're absolutely going to hate you as well. They're going to do all of these things to you because of me. And so, yeah, okay, maybe it's an op. Maybe we're being set up. Jesus told us that would happen. It's not surprising to us. We're not shocked when it happens. Like, it's so ridiculous. Like, yeah, okay, it's an op. And Jesus is king. So I don't know what you want to do about that. Like,
You do to me doesn't change that he's still king. Yeah, and you'll either repent of persecuting his church and find grace in his name, or you'll face him as the king who knows how to defend his bride. So, you know, it doesn't change a thing about it.
You're going to say it either way. So better now than then.
Yeah. I don't know how to suss this out, but I have suspected. I want to be clear. I don't want to make Christian nationalism equivalent to the gospel, but Christ is king is essential to the gospel. Christian nationalism is an attempt to say Christ is king is a navigating principle for civic life.
Yeah.
But I do wonder how much of this controversy about saying Christ is king and how much of the controversy within evangelicalism about Christian nationalism is Christians, I'm assuming some very sincere Christians, seeing the threat that the state is loading up against Christians and saying, is there a way I can style my faith in public that will help me to avoid the tidal wave that's coming? I don't want to get too speculative there because you can start thinking pretty ill of your brothers and sisters, but it's got to be the case that some of these otherwise thoughtful evangelicals who've just lost their minds over Christian nationalism are doing so from a place of fear.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. It's the impulse to not be, you know, the first ones loaded onto the train. And so even to the extent with some of these guys, I think Michael O'Fallon is a pretty heinous example of this, where he's almost ready to help point out and load up the other guys so that he can get off. Mm. But, you know, if you're faithful to Christ, like if you are a Christian, you're going to be on the train at some point. Like you're not going to get away from it. You're either going to have to abandon Christ or be loaded up with the rest of us.
Yeah. See, that's exactly what you're talking about. So like a Michael O'Fallon has been pretty heinous in his rhetoric. I'm with you on that. But like, these are guys that I'm rooting for to be actual Christians.
Yeah.
I want to tell them with all sincerity, it's not going to work, man. You're going to be, at some point, there's going to be a critical place. If these people are really what we all think they are and what you clearly think they are, there's going to be a place where we have to make the decision. So the thing to be doing is to be preparing to be faithful in that moment rather than like trying to develop some kind of super specific nuanced strategy to avoid it. If it's coming, it's coming. It's not going to be it's not going to be avoided by rhetorical tricks.
Yeah. Yeah. And the only other alternative is to, you know, try to outlast as long as you can. And that inevitably turns you into a traitor.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, or it's going to tempt you hard, right? You very hard to do that. And which means I guess you might be one of the last few onto the trains, but what kind of win is that?
Yeah.
Well, I think we've hit that. Guys, listen, be Christian. Who cares what bad people's reaction to
anybody says about it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's Christians. You pull the Trump card. Who cares?
Yep. Yeah. there's a lot of ways to talk about Trump cards on there, and that's an excellent transition. So you want to bring up the last topic here?
Yeah. Actually, this is kind of related to what we were saying about being reactionary, and this is more overtly political. Although I guess the Christ is King thing is in its own way as well. But another thing that's come up recently is the Trump's statement about abortion and pro-life matters and things like that. To preface this, I don't agree with Trump on this topic. I think I wouldn't call myself an abortion abolitionist. I totally agree with all of their goals, but I'm not stringent about how I think we should legislate that. I think we should take what we can get and then keep pushing for more.
That sounds like Wilson's smash mouth. What's he call it? Smash mouth incrementalism?
Oh, I
don't
know.
Are you familiar with that? Yeah. That seems to be kind of his take, that like, take everything you can get and always be pressing for full abolition.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. Okay. Then that's what I am. But I don't want to make it sound like I'm trashing abolitionists. I'm totally agree with their, you know, their goals and all of that. And I think that's good. And I love the work that they do, and would love to see them succeed. So all of that being said, Trump articulated basically what is the like pro-life incorporated view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. We should have exceptions for such and such, and
rape and incest.
Yeah. And, you know, so many weeks, heartbeat bills, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he talked about heartbeat bills specifically, but, you know, having certain limits, but not full abolition. And what was funny about that is that all of the people who have been arguing with the abolitionists about how extreme their views are now, because they found a safe right-wing figure to attack on these issues — they would never do this if it were a Democrat saying it. They would never do it if it were, you know, someone who is respectable. Mm-hmm. But because they've found the guy that it's in – this may not be the terms they're thinking in, but this is clearly what's happening — they found a guy that it's safe socially for them to attack on this issue. They've now all become basically abortion abolitionists. Like, they're arguing that Trump is actually pro-choice, even though the view he's articulating is basically what
theirs.
Pro-life. Yeah. The pro-life movement has been legislating this view and killing bills that are more, I don't want to say more extreme, but more right, That's what the pro-life movement has been doing for decades. And now, because Trump has articulated that position, it's evil and wrong and has to be opposed.
Right.
It's just wild.
Man, it is, you know, it's a group of evangelicals. So we're thinking about Brent Leatherwood at the ERLC, J.D. Yeah. Greer, head firmly, you know, lodged in his lower colon. all the national pro-life groups like the Susan B. Anthony people and all that. I didn't think I could think less of them until I watched this happen. You know, you're thinking through, I think you're actually being too charitable to them, because you're right that I think there's a class of people. Let's say if our listeners are familiar with Dan Darling. Like, I think a Dan Darling is very happy to say, oh, I have a respectable reason now to hate Donald Trump, right? I think there is a class of people like that. But at the level I'm talking about with the Leatherwoods, the national pro-life groups, it appears really as simply as, if Trump said it, I hate it, and never consider my own position or have any desire whatsoever to maintain internal consistency, which is why none of these people have come over to the abortion abolitionists and said, you know what, it took Trump saying it for me to really take stock of my position. But now that I've seen it framed in the words of someone I have a distaste for, I see where your criticisms are coming from, and I want to kind of rethink this position with you. None of that has happened. They've just weathervaned completely, holding the same position Trump does and criticizing him for holding it. We talk about them as craven so often. There's no other word. I wish we had a stronger word. It is craven and thoughtless and brain dead and immoral in a way that's just hard to articulate. But that's who these people are. They are as spineless as you've ever dared dream, and they are as thoughtless as you ever suspected they were.
Yeah.
And what do you do about it? I mean, we need a pressure washer to every major right-wing institution, basically. You think about American Reformer or a couple of new ones that maybe, you know, you say, well, not them, but if it's a right-wing organization that's older than 10 years, you probably just need to bleach the whole thing and start rebuilding.
Yeah. Yeah, it is tragic. And I mean,
Trump is wrong. I mean, we're on that. Right. Trump is wrong. Right. But he's wrong in the exact same way they have been opposing abortion abolition bills for years. Sorry, I don't mean, you can tell I'm on a soapbox about this. I just despise these people.
No, I'm with you. And I don't know what can be done about it, really, besides just, you know, like you said, taking a pressure washer and just abandon, like, these institutions just need to go. There's nothing of value there. It's just a class of people who somehow have made their, I don't know how to say it. They're employed to be these people. Like, the only mm-hmm. reason they have jobs is because they know the right times to attack the right. And they're put in a position where they have influence over right-wing people. And, all they stand for is just opposing what is good.
It is that simple. You know, it's hard, I guess, really to get your head around it, but it is that simple. They are there to attack anything that is unfashionable to leftist sensibilities within the right. And they do it like trained dogs. I mean, and again, here you're talking about, you know, these J.D. Greers and the Susan B. Anthonys and all these people. At this point, no one has to call them up and say, hey, you know, there's a sweet bonus in your consultant fee for, you know, if you'll come out and attack Trump on this. They're just viscerally trained at this point to do what the spirit of the age wants. They could not be more disgusting. They couldn't be more disgusting.
Yeah, it is the worst kind of quizlings that you can ask for.
Hireling. It is hireling, as you know, their whole personality and their whole moral compass is hireling. God deliver us from these fools.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Brent Leatherwood, you brought him up, is I just saw recently the example of him using the ERLC to push for funding for the Ukraine war, funding Ukraine.
Right.
And it's like, God, what in the world? What in the world does that have to do? You're Southern Baptist, so you can tell me. Maybe I'm missing something. Where in the ERLC's mission is petitioning the government to send more money to a foreign country to wage war? Where did this come from? Where do these guys? I mean, I know the answer is they just don't fear God.
Yeah. They don't fear God, and there's somebody giving them a paycheck, not just the ostensible paycheck, you know, that they're taking from the missions giving of churches, but there is some incentive, financial or otherwise, behind closed doors that is leading them to use the resources at their disposal to do corrupt things. And, you know, we're supposed to have a mechanism in the SBC to control that, these trustees who watch over these groups like the ERLC, but the trustees are bought. You know, the money is used to groom them into favoring the institution. Nobody wants to hold Brent Leatherwood accountable in the group of people that are supposed to hold him accountable. And so you just, I mean, you know, my prayer is that God would break their teeth. God be pleased to bring complete embarrassing ruination upon these people. For giving themselves to this wickedness. And Lord willing, he will. I mean, if our listeners want to join me in praying that, it would be wonderful if Leatherwood was made either repentant. I mean, that's what we all hope as Christians. You know, I despise the guy, but I can at least muster up. I hope he repents rather than reaping the full fruits of God's judgment. But if he's not going to repent, if that's not God's will, let it be a story that's told for generations about God's catastrophic judgment on Brent Leatherwood and everybody connected to the ERLC. Let it be a horror story that's told, you know, 1,000 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's pretty bleak, but that's
what we're this is the here. Black Pill episode of Backwoods Police.
Yeah. Well, I mean, seriously, Backwoods, I don't know, I can legitimately say, I don't know anybody who thinks Brent Leatherwood's doing a good job. I don't personally know a single person who does. And it's because those kind of fools self-isolate. They self-select out of reasonable circles. And they have, you know, that, I mean, that's why these guys fight so hard to get these positions and hold on to them, because they know they can't survive in the real world. There has to be this buffer built on good assumptions. You know, I was talking to somebody who was talking about the culture of Wheaton. And, you know, Wheaton's crazy. It's as crazy a place as... you would imagine a place that would bring Russell Moore and Ed Stetzer into leadership in, but they're living for as long as they can on the buffer of people who still think of Wheaton as like Billy Graham school. And these guys have to hide there for as long as they can because they cannot survive in the real world. And if you're listening to this and you live in the real world and you can say with me, I don't know anybody who thinks he's doing a good job. I know a ton of people who, if they had the ability, they would take him out of the position. Thank God, because you actually live in God's world.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the unfortunate, frustrating things about it is that all of the people who have a say are also kind of wrapped up in that managerial class. And they realize that if they tried to get, you know, like even if they had the desire to get Brent Leatherwood removed, the exact same argument can be used to remove them. And so it's sort of this, I mean, it is the old boys club, like, you know, if somebody's going to do it to somebody else, then it could be done to them as well. And so you just kind of are protective of those people.
Right. And they're all keeping their own petty little pipelines open, right? So Brent is keeping, you know, whatever options he has in terms of making money from outside sources, or when the house of cards falls, where he'll land a sweet consulting or think tank gig open, he's keeping that pipeline open through his behavior. The trustees are keeping their pipeline to, you know, getting a conference speaker gig or being flown in to a cush hotel during the conference and, you know, getting a kind of paid vacation that they can tell their church, oh, I'm doing trustee work. They're all kind of keeping their petty little benefits. And it's what's, you know, they're all bought and paid for.
Yeah, maybe he'll have a pipeline to Christianity Today or something like that.
Yeah, right.
Like the last head of the ERLC.
Right, right. A pox on them all, man. May God, yeah. May God bring their house down upon their heads.
Yeah, but, you know, it's a mess.
One ripping.
Yeah. The good news is that Christ is king.
Here, here.
And he sees and knows all of these things that are happening.
Yeah. And every one of his enemies is being brought beneath his feet. I mean, that's what his father is working on. And that's encouraging.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of encouraging, I saw today, I think, was it Chase Davis who posted it about what's happening at Acts 29?
Yeah.
Did you see this?
Yeah.
Like 60% of the churches in Acts 29 have not renewed their membership.
Yep.
That is significant. And it's a sign. It's a sign that these old institutions that are failing are just going to crumble. Like once the liberalism within, you know, starts to wear the skin suit of the once good institution, this always happens. They begin to crumble and die because, you know, the anti-gospel cannot create anything good.
Right.
Anti-human can't create anything good. It just purely sucks off the life of what has already been made. And so, well, you know, that's going to happen in Acts 29. That's going to happen to any of these. I mean, that's already happened to the ERLC. Does the ERLC do anything of benefit anymore?
No.
First of all, did it ever?
Yeah, I mean, I think at one point the ERLC was buying ultrasound machines to put in crisis pregnancy centers. So, yay. We have 6,000 different mechanisms to do that. Everything else that they do is useless.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just sad. I mean,
oh, dude, it's brutal. It's brutal when you know, like, the people who gave up their pensions to donate. You know what I mean? Like, when you can think about the women who went without because they thought they were giving to something that would serve Christ's glory, it's almost unbearable.
Yeah. All the faithful, you know, backwoods Southern Baptist churches who send their money to the cooperative program, and this is what they're funding.
Yep. Yep. Like you said, though, God sees, God knows, and those forces are already at work, you know. I wish they would materialize a little bit more quickly, but I also know God is gracious and long suffering. And so I have to remember that he is king, and that means he gets to make the time frame call.
Yep. Well, where do we go from here?
Man, I think it's time to land this plane. Again, grab bag episode. But be encouraged, friends. If you're seeing these things and you think they're crazy the same way we do, you're right. You're right. The Leatherwoods of the world, the evangelical institutional class, they couldn't be more corrupt. They couldn't be more loathsome. And you're actually aligned with the perspective of the kingdom, not because you agree with us or because we agree with you, but because we have an external reference point like we've been talking about. We know what Christ wants. And that means he's preserving a remnant like he always does. It means all of his purposes are coming to pass. Everything's on schedule. You know, be encouraged by that. Everything in the kingdom's on schedule.
Yeah. All right. I guess this will be a shorter episode today. I don't really have a whole lot more to say about it. And we kind of have already talked about, you know, what's the response. And it is really just trust the Lord. He knows what he's doing.
Yep. Absolutely.
So I guess we can land the plane.
Yeah, man. I will tell you this.
It feels like a bleak episode to me.
Yeah, I guess it's bleak if you look at the landscape.
Yeah.
But if you can kind of take a drone view that accounts for what Christ is doing and where he's seated, you realize this is all, I mean, it all must happen. He must reign until he puts all of his enemies under his feet. And it's happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the thing I was going to throw in there
go ahead.
I was just going to throw in that it has been a while. We've had topics to talk about. We've just been busy. But this is, again, one of those times I would just tell our listeners, if you're interested in hearing from us, we'd love to know what you want to talk, want to hear us talk about, what you want to engage with us on. So you can get to us on social media. Let us know. There's something that comes up and you're like, hey, would y'all talk about this? I'm pretty sure we'd be delighted to. And between now and then, we're at least going to talk about Pride Month. So We have one thing in the hopper, but if you want to throw something else in there, we'd love to consider it, or at least I would. I'd love to hear what you think we ought to be talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think by the time the last time we recorded, I had not done it yet, but I do now have those two videos out that I produced. That,
oh, yeah.
I talked a little bit about I talked a little bit about Wary's Law in the first one. So if you're curious about that, go ahead and listen to it. And then I did another one commenting kind of related about all of the criticisms of like the trad wife stuff going on around. So they're both on my Twitter. You can find them on there. Or there's a YouTube channel that I think it's just called Bendle Wary that you can search for and find those videos out there. So if you're curious to.
Yeah, I mean, so guys, you gotta go watch these. But Ben, is this how you crack the door open for us developing a YouTube channel for Backwoods Belief? Because we've had that request very frequently.
Oh, have we?
Yeah, we get a reply about that every now and then.
Oh, maybe we need a Backwoods Belief YouTube channel. I don't know.
Yeah, bring my face for podcasting to the video world. I have to put on a clean shirt. But anyway, maybe we'll do that. All right, man. Where can people find you?
Yeah, so at Bendle Wary on Twitter. That's pretty much anything I'm doing you'll be able to find there. That's about it.
Yeah, merely J Wright for me on the same place. If you're a Credo Baptist listening to this, I'm working with a group called Credo Alliance, and I mentioned we're having a pastor's conference call. If you're a Credo Baptist pastor, elder or other staff member of your church and want to get on that, please hit me up on social media. I'd love to have you invited to those calls.
Yeah. Oh, hey, before we finish up, this is only going to be relevant to some of our listeners, but probably a big portion. Do you want to give an update about kind of what's going on with the lead up to the Southern Baptist Convention? Anything new, or is it just kind of holding pattern until the convention happens?
Dude, it's a funny time to be a Southern Baptist. I mean, for all the reasons we just talked about. But as far as I know, we have the most candidates for the presidency that we've ever had in my adult lifetime. So we just had a sixth candidate announce. pastors First Baptist in Sevierville. A sixth presidential candidate. Most years there's two. A lot of years there's three. I don't think I've ever remembered four. And so we're at six. The SBC is in chaos because we have incompetent people leading it, and they're leading it in a way that's entirely contrary to who our people actually are at the church level. And this is just another symptom of that. But the best candidate running is Jared Moore. He's running as the Credo Alliance candidate. He's a pastor from Crossville. He's faithful. Jared's awesome.
He's been on the podcast.
Yeah. It would be such a gift of God for Jared to be elected. We have another good candidate named
David Allen. Oh, I think I may have lost Jeff. Yep, there he is. Yeah, you're back now.
Sorry, I don't know what happened. But yeah, David Allen, the other four, you just need to, you know, they're not real candidates. They'll just continue doing in one way or the other. They'll just keep continuing what's wrong with SBC. And really the only thing that differentiates them is the pace at which the SBC will be, you know, it will self-immolate. Yeah. So you got two candidates, one's, you know, in a class, you know, like there's one clear number one, there's a clear number two, and then there's nothing after them. But yeah. Who knows, maybe we'll get more candidates.
So the way you guys do elections, though, having a bunch of candidates doesn't really hurt because somebody needs to get 50%.
Right. You eventually wheedle down to a runoff. And so we've got Jared running for Credo, but the we've got a great slate behind him. So Michael Cleary is running for vice president. Praise the Lord for that. Michael is by far the best candidate who's thrown his hat in. And then we have these other guys that are in queue that we're going to announce over time. We'd love to see a full slate of Credo candidates elected because it would be the people who could actually salvage the SBC and be used of God to return her. So, you know, if you're listening, pray for us. The SBC matters. You know, it may not be your particular denomination. You may think of it as fuddy-duddy, but if you're thinking about institutional evangelicalism, you're thinking about the SBC. And so it matters. It matters enough that the bad guys want to take it. And so it should matter enough to us to say you don't get to.
Mm-hmm. I mean, is it the largest Is it the largest evangelical denomination in the United States, or just the largest Protestant one?
Oh, we're the largest Protestant, yeah. Not just evangelical. Okay. So it's like Roman Catholics and then us. We educate most of the seminarians from every evangelical. I mean, again, you can think the SBC is a ball of goof, but George Soros doesn't.
Yeah.
And it's because it has a huge footprint.
Yeah. Yeah. So even if you're not Southern Baptist, even if you're not Baptist, what happens in the SBC in America actually matters.
Right. Absolutely right.
All right. Well, with that, I think we'll call it a day. Thank you for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at Backwoods Belief. Interact with us on there. We'd love to hear from you. And thanks for listening.